So we're looking at the aesthetic moment, and we've looked so far at the objective element in the aesthetic moment, and yesterday the subjective element in the aesthetic moment, what I've called the known and the knower. Now we need to look a little bit at the knowing, which is in some ways the most interesting and most difficult to talk about. But let's approach it by an experience that's probably familiar to you in your own terms, in your own experience. The point at which, when you're engaged with any kind of aesthetic object, you turn on to it, to use a 60s term. You find yourself engaged with it. It can be very striking, that shift. And it must be equivalent, in a way, to passing over the threshold in meditation into jhana. And I think a lot of what we're talking about, obviously, is the same as happens in meditation. I think that the relationship to art and to meditation is very, very close. So I remember a very striking experience of my own in this regard. Not that it was particularly exalted or anything like that, but it was the unexpectedness and the starkness of it that really struck me. I'd been invited to Singapore to the opening of the Buddhist Library. And, well, you can imagine, they paid my fare to go to Singapore. They treated us, Deva Mitra and I, like royalty. They really treated us so well, so careful, so attentive. I've never eaten so much Chinese food, but of the most exquisite kind. And all of it, what they call temple vegetarian, so that it looks like meat, it tastes like meat, but it's not meat. Not meat as we know it. But they kept us pretty occupied with seeing various sites of Singapore, which is a rather strange place in many ways, a fascinating place. But that one afternoon they sent us off to the National Art Museum. And like many sort of collections of that kind, it's sort of an assembly of minor works by everybody. I couldn't really engage. For a start, it was just so strange looking at all this Western art, mainly Western art, or Western art done by Singaporeans, in the middle of this strange city, which is very unique, city-state. And So I was doing it because it was on the programme kind of thing, and cursorily looking at this and looking at that. And we went into a room of French Impressionists, as I say, minor works by everybody. And I came in front of a painting by Pissarro. It was a painting of a Normandy harbour. And in a way, I don't know whether it was much of a painting to this day, but suddenly the painting just grabbed me, as I described the way in which a work does. It sort of pulled me into it. And I found myself in a completely different state of mind, state of consciousness. Unawares, startled, I hadn't been trying. I don't think it was a great piece of art. It was a pretty good piece of art. But suddenly I found myself in a completely different state of mind, a different state of knowing. And the contrast between the previous mode of perception and that mode was so striking that it really set me thinking about what is going on in the aesthetic mode. So I'm interested to try and understand what that difference is, what's going on. And in order to do so, I want to start off by offering some sort of analysis of different modes of knowing. Generally speaking, we use two modes of knowing in the midst of our routine lives, so to speak. The first and most obvious one is the mode of perceiving. We perceive a world full of objects in which we stand to some relationship. Our senses deliver us information. We assemble from that information a complex whole, which is a world. And we view that world from a single perspective, unity of perspective, which all seems completely normal, natural, real, presents itself to us in that way. So that's the first mode of knowing, the standard mode of knowing, the one that most people probably would think of as real, the real world, the common sense world, not in the strict sense of common sense, but the normal sense of common sense, the common sense use of common sense, not the real one. So that's the first mode of knowing. Which is one most people occupy all the time. And we take that mode of knowing to deliver us reality. We think that what we're getting through that mode of knowing is the real world occupied by a real person. Quite unthinkingly, quite naturally, we think like that. This is what you could call the original disposition of the mind, the way in which the whole organism is structured, so that it knows the world without any effort on our part. We're just trained like that from evolutionary ancestry and our parents' interaction with us. The second mode of knowing, of course, is strongly related to that, and it is the mode of knowing that is conceptualizing, where we break up the overall flow of our perceptual experience, our perceptual knowing, into generalized concepts. So, you know, I generalize people. I generalize audience, or whatever you are, auditors. I generalize a ceiling. Actually, this ceiling is completely unique. Every particle of this ceiling is irreproducible, and it cannot really be captured by the blunt term ceiling. But it's extremely useful if I want to get Yashodeva to fix it, because I say to him, go into the Dhamma hall and fix the ceiling. And he knows what I mean. So I translate the minute particularity of my experience into portable concepts that generalize, abstract from that experience, and that I can then carry into the future with me and can also transport to others. I can communicate to others. That's conceptualizing. It derives from perceptual knowing, and indeed, it, properly speaking, returns to perceptual knowing. When I transport to Yashodeva the concept of ceiling, I do it in order that he can go to the ceiling and do something to it. So knowing in the form of conceptualizing, and of course verbalizing, which is a department, so to speak, of conceptualizing, it's sort of second-hand experience. It's an abstraction, generalization from perceptual experience into the medium, so to speak, of concepts, which I can then use to locate myself in space and time, learn from the past, make plans for the future. Give a talk at a retreat that's been organised in a centre that's been built in a world that's threatened by an atom bomb. if you see what I mean. All of that structure of human, I was going to say civilization, sometimes it's hardly that, human culture is mediated by the ability to use concepts. Sheep are not very good at doing much more than chewing grass. They can't decide what they're going to do. They can't organise things. They can't learn from experience. We know they lost their lamb. I wonder what's going to happen to the next one. And so on. They don't learn because they can't conceptualise. They can't transport their experience. So these are two primary modes of knowing. We know by perceiving, and we know by conceptualizing. And much of the routine of our lives, and my goodness, isn't all life pretty much routine, is under the heading of perceiving and conceiving. But I hope that from what I've said so far, we already begin to recognize the limits of perceiving and thereby of conceiving. Perceiving is limited because it's not perceiving reality, it's perceiving images, which are in some mysterious way related to what we might call reality, or what seems to us to be reality, what we cannot but think of as reality. There's a whole fascinating question there that I'm not going to go into today, but which is worthy of much closer inspection, the relationship between the image and something that appears to be a reality standing behind, so to speak, the image. But what we perceive are images. It's not reality. It's not the great tradition, starting with Kant, called the thing in itself. We don't perceive whatever it is that the image is an image of, even though even that, of course, is a conceptualized image drawn from our perceived world, if you see what I mean. The idea that there is something standing behind. Here, the metaphor, standing behind our experience. So our perceiving is actually, Schopenhauer called representing, what Yogacara calls vijñapti, which it seems to be connected with the idea of sort of a message or an information coming to us from somewhere else. And this is not high philosophy, this is common sense. If you start to reflect upon what is going on in perceiving, it's quite straightforward to see that what you're perceiving are not things, but the images that you, in effect, create. Out of what, on what basis? Well, that's another question, that's another debate, which I'm not going to have now. Insofar as conceiving is the generalization from perceiving, representing, you might say, well, it must be, again, what Schopenhauer called representation of representation. It's a reconstruction of a reconstruction. And it's very useful, very valuable. It gets us all here more or less on time. It gets you to understand what I'm talking about. And it gives you useful means of discussion afterwards. But in the end, you've got to go back to direct experience. So much for those two forms of knowing. They're very useful. They're very effective, especially for getting breakfast and getting into a shrine room and all that sort of thing. But communicating information between us, arranging things and so on. Very, very important, very useful. But as regards the fullness of reality, strictly limited. Strictly limited in the sense that, the solar system is strictly limited. It's still a long way from the sun to the outer boundaries of the Kuiper Belt or whatever. But it's limited. How can we go further? How can we investigate further. Obviously, there's a problem immediately, because we're going to be talking in terms of words and concepts. And those words and concepts we've already seen are representations of representations. So in trying to talk about anything, that any means of knowing that goes beyond or behind or underneath or around or however you like to talk about it, you're constrained to use concepts that are derived from within the field of representation. So here we have to recognize that we've got different languages available to us. When we're speaking of representation, you could say we're using the language of objects. When we're speaking the language of perception, we're speaking the language of objects. Of course, it's conceptual, but it's concepts that are immediately related to perceptual experience as description. So that's the first level of language. It's language as descriptive of perception, perceptual description. Then we've got the language of abstract conceptualization, where we take even a step further away from the immediacy of perceptual description, and we discuss more and more generally. You know, there are only fine shades of difference between these two, but there's definite difference. One is, if you like, first order, one is second order. So we've got, if you like, the language of perceptual description and the language of abstract conception. I'm using a mixture of two. You know, sometimes I described my experience in the Singapore Art Gallery. Well, that's conceptual description to some extent. Perceptual description. But then I'm starting to draw larger themes and larger understandings from that. That's conceptual use of language, use of words, use of terms. Both those languages are strictly bounded by the limitations of space and time and of causality. I've described a number of times over the last few days that we locate our strict experience, our literal experience, so to speak, within space, time and causality. We see it distributed in space as being part of a flow of time, and as being related to everything around it in a relationship of causality. So all our perceptual language, all our conceptual language, is bounded by space, time and causality. So what lies beyond those, strictly speaking, we cannot talk about. And this is the wonder of the Buddha, isn't it? That he managed to say so much whilst refusing to say what he couldn't say. What he knew saying was dangerous to say. And that's the difference between Buddhism, in my humble opinion, said he in a proud sort of way, and all other religion. For instance, Hinduism, which strays into vast speculations about the ultimate nature of things and their relationship to the intimate relationship of things, and thereby presenting huge hostages to fortune of understanding and misunderstanding, so that you can have a caste system whilst believing in an ultimate Atman and so on, if you see what I mean. As soon as you step away into the speculative realms which try to talk about what is untalkable in talkable terms, you buggered it up, and you've led to all sorts of possibility of evil, actually, evil, as that religion so easily lends itself to, all religion. The Buddha refused to do that, and he was very well aware, it's obvious, of the limitations of those two modes of talking, of two modes of speaking. But Nonetheless, we sort of have to go a bit further. We have to go a bit further because we need to have some relationship to what does go further. Otherwise, we begin to think that we're just stuck with the world of representation, and that's it. When the eyes close, the night lights go out, and that's it. Fortunately, we have another language, a language that actually is very much alive even in the Buddha's own discourse, but not so consciously referred, which is the language of images. The language of images takes us into what cannot be spoken of in terms of the language of perceptual representation and the language of conceptual representation. The language of images takes us closer to the truth of things. The language of images takes us into another mode of knowing, or it is the language of another mode of knowing. And that other mode of knowing, of course, is imagination. Imagination, which is, I would argue, the real mode of knowing. Even our perceptual knowing is a form of imagining. I think I made that clear on the second day when I spoke about the way in which the images that we have in our minds, however they're conditioned, they are imagination. Whatever it is that conditions them, they are imagination. They are not something independent of us. And then the third day, I spoke of, that was yesterday in fact, it seems years ago, the way in which I am an image. When I take myself, when I begin to experience myself, especially under the impact of the aesthetic object, when I find myself departing from the framework of time and causality, I experience myself as an image. I don't necessarily think of it like that, but when we think about that experience, well, the best way we can think of it is as an image. So all our experience ultimately is imagination. All our experience is imagination. Even our concepts are derived from the representations which are the work of imagination. Imagination is our real life. It's our real knowing. It's what consciousness really means, ultimately. And in a sense, you could say that consciousness and imagination are interchangeable terms. You can think of so many different terms that would interchange with imagination. Love, even, might be a term for imagination. But imagination has a unique power to help us to understand our experience, and to understand our experience especially in the context of aesthetic moment. The aesthetic moment is where we let go of the mode of knowing that is perceiving. We've certainly let go of the mode of knowing that is conceiving. We've stopped thinking. If you're thinking, the aesthetic moment is strictly limited. And that's what's so problematic about so much modern art. It requires you to do a lot of thinking. But it may be that, of course, that thinking generates in you a more immediate experience. That's fine. But the more your little brain is ticking out concepts, the less aesthetic the experience is. As I say, concepts can work the other way. They can point you towards imagination. I suppose that's poetry. And that's really intelligent Dhamma teaching and so on, that just directs you beyond the world of representation to the world of imagination and of direct imaginative experience. So yes, when you're in the aesthetic moment, you've left behind perceiving in the narrow sense of interpreting your experience under the headings of space-time and causality, even, to some degree, slackening its interpretation in terms of subject and object, slackening it in terms of subject and object insofar as subject and object become image, image perceiving image. It's a very telling phrase from Bante's St. Jerome Revisited, which is an extraordinary work, which I'm drawing on quite substantially in the background of everything that I'm saying, filtered through Yogacara, Schopenhauer, Kant, and a little bit of my own confusion. But Bante speaks of the aesthetic experience as leading you to the point at which you experience pure image, and you realize that you are image perceiving image. There is image perceiving image. When the imagination flowers or begins to flower, image perceives image. Image imagines image. There is only imagining going on. It doesn't mean you go into some sort of fantasy. It doesn't mean that you suddenly start constructing angels flapping their wings all over the place. It may do, but it may be simply that everything is the same. Everything is exactly the same, but you're imagining it rather than perceiving it or conceiving it. It's illumined. You've separated yourself from the construction of your experience in terms of space, time, and causality. You've definitely separated yourself from the abstraction of experience in terms of conceiving. And you're experiencing the world as imagination. Ringing in my mind over the last months has been that phrase of Blake's that comes in a catalogue to some of his paintings, an exhibition of some of his lithographs. Name escapes me at the moment. But he talks of... he says, I look not... I'm not quoting exactly, but anyway, he says something like, I look not with the eye, but through the eye. Perceiving is looking with the eye. So you take the eye's messages literally. I am here, it is there. And the eye is a literal window on the world. That's looking with the eye. When you look through the eye, you're experiencing the image. And you're experiencing yourself as image. You're experiencing yourself as liberated from the literalism of space-time and causality, at least of time and causality. Space, of course, still is there because there's an object there. And as you leave behind the world of representation, the world of perceiving, and you realize it is representation, this is what Yogacara is really talking about. It's talking about recognizing that our constructed world, our perceived world, is but vijñapti, representation, messages, images arising in the transformations of consciousness as consciousness unfolds. So we can directly experience what is going on right now as image. You let go of its literal straitjacket. You don't see anything different. The images on your that are erected in your mind, that are constructed or created in your mind, are no different. But you know them. You directly experience them. Not know with your thinking brain, you know, like my words are telling you. Not like that. But you know directly from your immediate experience that these are representations. These are vijñapti. These are images. This is an image. And you know that you are an image. Right now, right here, in this situation, that's what's happening. These images are arising causes and conditions. Causes and conditions that are unfathomable, ultimately, because you can only follow them so far. It's only useful to follow them so far. Only useful insofar as you're engaged with the world of representation and conceiving. When you let go of that world, you simply experience the creative fountain of images. Images unfolding like a flower. I remember Bhante talking about the mandala of the five Buddhas on that wonderful seminar on the Tibetan Book of the Dead, which is a sort of foundational experience for me. When I had quite a lot of direct pointing going on for me, just listening to Bhante, that's direct pointing. Try it sometime. If you just really listen to what he's saying, he's pointing to reality. And he talked about the way in which in the Bardo state, the five Buddha mandala sort of efflorescens. So first of all, you get each Buddha figure emerging one after the other, day by day, in a rather Procrustean sort of way. But you can take that as an image rather than so literal, this day, that. It's an image for something that is beyond all such temporal constructions. And what then happens is they begin to riot. The Buddhas begin to explode. It's first of all, the Buddha explodes into five Buddhas. Then each of the Buddhas explodes into multiple Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And then they explode into all sorts of weird and wonderful figures, Paisachis and Gauris and all sorts of things. The imagination efflorescens. And Bhante spoke at the time of this representing or being an image for enlightenment itself. Otherwise, you think of enlightenment as sort of coming to an end. And in a certain sense, it is a coming to an end. It's a coming to an end of the clinging to representations as literally applying to me and things. It's a coming to the end of concepts as actually describing reality. It's a coming to the end of all that. But in imaginative terms, it's not the coming to end of anything. It's the beginning of everything. So imagination, when we really allow ourselves to experience imagination free from, increasingly free from, the boundaries of representation, the boundaries of perceptual representation, the boundaries of conceiving. The more and more we let go of that, the more and more we experience ourselves as image, imagining image. And we experience that image as imagining image as an inexhaustible fountain of creative energy, if you want to call it anything. You become so aware when you start to talk in this field that language is so banal, so flat, so dull, and so inexact, and necessarily pushes you back down exactly where you're trying to get away from. If only one had the voice of a prophet or a poet or one in ecstasy or something like that, but one has only flat, prosaic words to describe what is the exact opposite. But that's what art does for us. Art in combination with everything else that we do in our spiritual lives, in our Dhamma lives, it enables us to enter the world of imagination. It protects us from all the falsities of imagination, or the false trails of imagination, because, as I've already indicated, imagination can so easily turn merely to egoistic fantasy, self-delusion. It can turn to madness, but madness is really the confusion of the literal with the imaginative. It's when you cannot distinguish properly between the imaginative realm and the literal realm. And that's what superstition is, isn't it, in religion? It's where you cannot understand a metaphor. you can only see the metaphor literally. You know, if you say, my love is like a red, red rose, you're looking for her thorns. get it. So imagination does need safeguards. And just a little plug, right at the end of my paper on reimagining the Buddha, I've written something I think is one of the most important things that I've done in those papers, which is 5 safeguards of imagination, which I think it's quite important to visit. And I think if you're examining this area, you need to recognise this. Otherwise, what you seem to be doing is advocating madness and fantasy. I've even experienced this in talking about the field of imagination. I've realised that one or two of my auditors are justifying their own delusions. So without the safeguards to imagination, without a real recognition of the nature of perceiving, and a real recognition of what conceiving means, imagining is delusion, fantasy, self-infatuation, and worse, it's evil. It's really important to make sure that when we exercise imagination, we do it with all those safeguards. So art can lead us deep into the imagination. I believe the greatest of artists touch those depths, and they do lead us to the gateways of reality itself, you might say, Yatha Bhuta. They lead us to things as they really are. They show us imagination as the life of everything. Imagination as the force that generates all our experience in accordance with the principles of conditionality when viewed under the heading of space, time and causality. And without art, I think we very easily become absorbed in technique and conception. And our realizations are merely conceptualizations. Clever, deep, penetrating, even important conceptualizations. But they lack the power, the breadth, the depth, the ineffability of imagination that sweeps us into dimensions where we are just image, and what we're perceiving, what we're imagining, is just image. Indeed, I've come to think that the way in which one would apply the idea of no self here is not in terms of recognizing that there is no image that is you, but is recognizing that you are an image. You are an image, and, well, you could say, and no more. But that makes it seem like being an image is not very much, but that you are an image, and that that image is no different from the image that the image knows, that it's no different from the imagination itself, that image, imagining image, is reality itself. Further than that, of course, I can't go, and even in what I've said so far, I've given so many hostages to fortune that I probably should shut up while the going is good. But I hope that I've given you some flavour of the depths to which even our aesthetic moment can take us, and in which the greatest aesthetic guides that humanity has produced so far, created so far, can take us deep, deep indeed. I began by talking about Bhante's reference to Wordsworth's lines written above Tintern Abbey. And it's very striking that Bhante considered that those words took us to the same depths, or to at least to the threshold of the same depths as the Dhamma takes us to. He's not going to be so foolish as to pronounce on where exactly Wordsworth is in the scale of things. As we know, scales are ridiculous. They just come from the world of space and time. What a joke. They take us, somebody like Wordsworth takes us very deep indeed. And you remember Bhante's resolution of his problem of Buddhism and art, the Dhamma or art, in Sangharakshita 1 and Sangharakshita 2. It came in that moment when he was teaching a bunch of Indian school children, schoolboys, Shelley's The Cloud. Interestingly enough, the daughter of a couple of order member friends of ours in India, Kamala Shri and Kumarajeev, their daughter Sayuri, had been studying The Cloud at school. And she said she got into a lot of trouble because she refused to answer the questions the teacher was asking them. You know, what does the cloud mean? She just wouldn't have it. She knew there was more to it than the cloud is blah, blah, blah. So she asked me to go through with it with her, a 12-year-old girl. So we went through it, and both our minds were blown away. But I could see exactly what Bhante meant. He said that when he was teaching these students the cloud, not in the way they were supposed to learn it, but by really penetrating deeply into the poem, that he found that without trying to, without meaning to, he was talking the Dhamma. Without changing his language, without moving from one to the other, not consciously doing so, he found that he was speaking in the same depths as he would be if he was speaking the Dhamma. Now, let's not get all literal about this and decide whether Schopenhauer, Shelley was a stream entrant or not. But what you get the point that when we start to engage with art at its depths, and the greatest of art, and I'm afraid there is greater and lesser art, we'll argue about that another time if you want to. But the greatest of art touches those depths because the artists themselves have touched those depths, and they've the skill, the craft to communicate their insight and understanding in the sensuous medium that is before them. In Shakespeare, in creating a Hamlet, has not merely created a wonderful dramatic piece that is engaging. One thing I find really interesting about Hamlet: you can never see the same Hamlet twice. Every performer of Hamlet interprets it differently, because there's something about the creation of Hamlet that evades final description, evades final analysis. He's touched on the depth of humanity, on the depth of what it is to be alive, what it is to know. So the greatest of the artists, and some of them are very great indeed, and maybe many have glimpses and are able to communicate something, they take us right into the heart of reality, because they show us our own imaginations. They show us imagination itself, not our imagination, but imagination itself. Because it's beyond the boundaries of space and time, and therefore beyond the boundaries of number, I and thine, one and two. There's just imagination, and we are image imagining image.